Good morning. Good morning, Professor Gabbé. It's a pleasure to get to chat with you this morning. As we've discussed ahead of time, the purpose of this interview is to discuss the emergence of replica symmetry breaking ideas in the physics community, which we bound roughly from 1975 to 1995. But before we get to that, we have a few questions on background, if you don't mind us asking. And first, in a very generic term, can you tell us a bit more about your family and your studies before starting university?
That's interesting. Okay, so yes. So my family emigrated from Turkey to France, and their general profession was they were merchant. So they were selling carpets, but even at that time, they felt that culture and education were paramount in order to, you know, to find a better life. And so when they moved to France, first of all, they had already a very good knowledge of French. They had themselves been educated even in Turkey within the French system. And so quite naturally, when I was born and raised, they considered it very important for me to continue as in higher education if possible. And even though my father would have loved if I had joined the business, I made it clear that this was not my major interest, that I was more attracted towards science in general. And I would say that I was not particularly good at math or physics, for that matter, in high school. And it is only because when, you know, I followed this track to apply for the so-called grandes écoles system. There was a math professor who was really a great inspiration for me. And all of a sudden, sort of, you know, I started blooming in this. And similarly, I had a physics professor there who himself was from a family of Guignet's family, so they were very good scientists, and in fact, my professor Guignet's brother was at my current university, Université d'Orsay, and he taught crystallography there, and he wrote a book which is an authority in the field. So this was for me some introduction to science. And then I joined École Normale Supérieure de Saint-Cloud, as it was called back then, which is now École Normale Supérieure de Lyon. That's the new name. And if I mention this, it is because there, there were two people who were, I would say, studying, where they were about my age. One was Thomas Garel, the other was Henri Orland. And we will come back to that because, indeed, a lot of the studies we conducted on spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking was with them. So, indeed.
So from your studies in Lyon, what then led you to pursue graduate studies in theoretical physics?
Essentially procrastination. I mean, this is, you know, this was, I would say, the easy way to continue. I mean, I of course, as I said, I had developed a strong interest in science, so certainly this was an incentive. But the École Normale system essentially, at least originally, prepared you not necessarily for doing research graduate studies, but to be a professor in high school. So there was this this national exam called Agrégation, and essentially at the end of the 4 years at École Normale, you took this exam and you were offered a position in high school. But this was not, I mean, I took it as everybody else, but I knew already at that stage that this was not what I wanted to do. And I had, during the 4 years I was at my École Normale, I had started a master's degree program at the time. So master's two, as it is known now, but at the time it was called DEA, nothing to do with drug enforcement agency, but it's a Diplôme d'études approfondies in French. And I had, courses with Jacques Fridel, who was a very strong scientist personality, André Blandin, who became my thesis advisor, and other people, I mean, Guigné, as I mentioned. And then I loved it. I mean, this was truly, all of a sudden, I discovered the realm of of real physics, of the, not just academic physics, but doing research, trying to confront, I would say, your ideas with what physics is telling you. Is it right? Is it wrong? Can we have more ideas about things? So this particular program, this master's program, became for me a very strong incentive to continue in doing a, I would say, a thesis. And at the time, there were two theses in France. One was a short thesis, 1 year or 18 months, a little bit equivalent to the Diplom Arbeit in Germany. So it was sort of an introduction to research. And at the end of it, either you were accepted for the for PhD or program or for a thesis program, or you did something else. And the longer program, so the thesis, was typically 5 years for theoretical physics and 10 years for experimental physics. It's a very, very long time. I have no idea why 10 years. I mean, what's so special about 10 years? And 5 years is not unreasonable. I mean, it's clearly 2 years longer than what it is now, but at least it's in the correct ballpark. And certainly in comparison to what's done in the US, for example, that's okay. That's perfectly fine. But in any event, as we say, I had two left hands. So experimentally speaking, I was not exactly very gifted. So theory became the natural track for me. And and that's basically the reason why I went into this field.
So as you mentioned, for your thesis, you joined the Fridel group, or the larger group, right? And so you said you worked mostly with André Blandin, but you also collaborated with Marie-Thérèse Béal during your thesis. Can you tell us a bit more about how the group functioned and what was going on at that point?
Yes. Okay. So indeed, I mentioned that there were two theses, a short one, 18 months. Was called the thèse de troisième cycle, third cycle thesis, And I did this with Marie-Thérèse Béalmoni. I would say one of the things that we had been trained for during the time when, you know, we were at École Normale was, as I said, you know, we were trying to be good at math, and we had energy and we could do a lot of things. So so Marie-Thérèse Béalmono, she's known as Zazie, so Zazie gave me a challenge. And this challenge was really mathematical. To me, I said, I will meet that challenge, and I did. She was surprised that I met it, but I met it, and for the defense, Jacques Friedel was a member of the jury, and I remember very vividly, you know, there's some mathematical challenge had been posed, and I wanted to meet it. And so I told Friedel very naively, I said, here, I met the challenge, and I'm sure that experimentally this can be checked. And I saw the Friedel's face, and I realized that reality was maybe a little bit more complicated than I had thought. So certainly from a mathematical standpoint, this was okay. This was a nice piece of work. But in terms of practical interest for the physics community, this was more questionable. However, you know, however, one never knows. And as it turns out, years later, in Sherbrooke, Canada, there were people who used the results I had established as, you know, an unfledged researcher. So one never knows. But to be honest, the practical implications of this thing were not so great. So you were asking, you know, how were things in the group at that time? And I would say that when I was doing this work for Marie-Thérèse Béalmono, so they were the young ones. I mean, we were the Padawans, if one uses Star Wars terminology. So the untrained ones. And we were together. I was already sharing an office with Thomas Garel, who actually was a family friend. He was 1 year ahead of me, but I would say we reconnected at this point, and we shared a lot of ideas. First, about the things that I was doing. Second, the kind of things he himself was doing. Then there were the other people in Orsay, and it is very funny. I will say something which stayed with me, even though it may seem very odd nowadays, but I did this work with Marie-Thérèse Béalmono, Zazie, back in 1977. And that was like 9 years after May 68 events, which took the world, you know, by storm. And very oddly, I mean, at least to me, the group, the theory group, was divided into factions. So there were the anti-1968, the pro-1968, and within the pro-1968, there were the communists and there were the leftists, absolute leftists, and they did not speak to one another. So us, you know, it didn't mean anything to us. We were there to learn physics, and we realized that there were these factions which essentially lived or still live politics almost 10 years later. So we had very little contacts, except, as I said, so I was in the neutral group. Zazie was definitely not a 1968 person, and she had been a student of Jacques Fidel. So Fidel, I would say, was in this subgroup, and Blandin, same thing. So we spoke with them, but I would say that the students were keeping between themselves.
So in that context, how did you first hear about spinning glasses and ideas of the replica trick, for instance?
Yes. So I had three mentors during this 4-year time period when I worked on this problem. So Blandin was the first one, and I would say that he really was the father founder of this replica symmetry breaking story, and I will explain. The second mentor was Cyrano de Dominicis in Saclay. And the third one was Gérard Toulouse at École Normale. So what happened was when after my third cycle thesis, this short thesis, I went around, I shopped around to see who could be a thesis advisor, the longer one. And the first person who said, yeah, okay, I'll take you as a PhD student was Pierre Feuty. So Feuty and Toulouse, they had done a lot of work about critical phenomena. And so the general idea that Pierre Feuty was proposing had to do with critical phenomena, but it's hard to tell, in advance if some ideas that you are thinking about will amount to much or not. And after a year, so 1978, it didn't look like anything might come out of this idea that Pierre Petit had suggested. And he had taken not only me as a student, but Thomas Garel as well. So the two of us were in the same book. And then Blandin saw the two of us, and because he was a very nice person, I can say, very considerate, he realized that, maybe he could sort of take over as an advisor for the two of us. And almost immediately, so after a few months, I very clearly remember one day, it was a Sunday, the phone rang in my home, and then I picked up the phone, and Blandin said, we've got to meet in this cafe in Montparnasse. There's something. I had no idea what this was about, but then when I arrived in Montparnasse, he was there with his nephew, who was 14 years old. And then Blandin said, I've had this fantastic idea about spin glasses. So to me, the word did not even mean anything. What was spin glasses? I had no clue. And I can only imagine that the 14-year-old nephew must have been even more mystified than I was, probably. And then Blandin started excitedly to jot down on a piece of paper some you know, some ideas, and some of the things that he was trying to explain, I could understand, but others did not really register at first. But in retrospect, of course, I realized that he had the right idea. And essentially what he was sort of thinking, he said, look, when we think of, I would say, some phase transition, some critical phenomenon, in most cases, we think about some kind of order parameter. And according to Landau, if there is some kind of order parameter, it means that there is some kind of symmetry that would be broken. And he said, what I have seen so far in the approaches about spin glasses, Edwards and Anderson, or Sherrington and Kirkpatrick later, I don't see that there is any kind of symmetry that's been broken. And this was really the idea. You had the right idea. And of course, at that time, I said 1978, there were two seminal papers, theoretical papers on, I would say, the mean field theory of spin glasses. And we know that mean field is the first thing you do if you try to attack some problem, if you suspect that there is some phase transition or whatever. So for the Sherrington Kirkpatrick model, there were replicas that had been introduced. So Sherrington and Kirkpatrick introduced some order parameter in terms of this replica. The second paper, seminal paper, that there was the Thallus, Anderson, and Palmer, in which they had written, equations of motions, if one would like, or, you know, they had constructed the free energy, but which was based on some expression for local magnetizations on site, etc. Then they could introduce, obviously, an order parameter which looked very much like the Sherrington Kirkpatrick order parameter. So these two things were there, but in both cases, Blondin said, I don't see that there is anything that has been broken so far. So he said, okay, let me try and see if there is a symmetry in this problem that can be broken. And he realized that when you introduced replicas in the problem, it meant that you introduced an additional symmetry, which was the permutation group of the replicas. And so he said, breaking the symmetry means breaking replica symmetry in the problem. And that was the idea. So of course, so, you know, as soon as he had realized that and I had understood what he meant, which took a little bit of time, because first I had to sort of get up to speed about what spin glasses were. So I read a lot about the literature on that problem. And then, of course, the paper by Sherrington Kirkpatrick and by Thallus, Anderson, and Palmer. And then, you know, we started doing some calculations. And of course, there was a little bit of a disappointment because the problem with this replica symmetry breaking a la Sherrington Kirkpatrick was the fact that when dealing with discrete spins, eigenspins to be more specific, one should not expect to find a negative entropy. And unfortunately, their solution produced negative entropy. And also, an odd thing was happening, namely that the free energy in terms of this order parameter turned out to be a maximum instead of being a minimum, as one would expect. So with the breaking of replica symmetry, the entropy was less negative, but was still negative. And then, obviously, you could say, okay, so I have broken replica symmetry a certain way. I can make things in a more clever way, and perhaps this will remedy these problems. And incrementally, indeed, by working on more sophisticated schemes, we were able to find solutions that sort of were getting better and better, or less bad and less bad. But still, the same problem remained. And okay, so there was something that was missing. And of course, the one person who found the solution was Giorgio Parisi. And I remember very clearly, I mean, you know, the at that time, papers on that subject were published basically in two journals. I mean, there was Nuovo Cimento, of course, for Italy. There was Journal de Physique, or Journal de Physique Lettres for the French part. And there were Journal of Physics, A for math, or C for condensed matter in Britain. And this, the reason I'm mentioning these journals is because the groups that were very actively involved in this story were, you know, there was sort of France, there was Britain, and there was Italy to some extent. There was also in the US, but not a lot. I mean, there were not many people who worked on that field at the time. And Giorgio Parisi, I remember the first paper that I read of his was in Journal of Physics, Physics Letter. So the Dutch journal, and it was like two pages. And I said, what is this thing? Doesn't seem to mean anything at all. What? I mean, he claims that there is no negative entropy, that that the problem is solved, and what? And I just could not understand. And of course, it took a while for people to realize that he got it. He got the right solution.
So
Patrick, can I ask one question. So the idea of coupling, of adding a coupling between two replicas to break explicitly the replica symmetry, this was already present in this conversation with Blandin that you mentioned in the Café Montparnasse?
Absolutely. That's what he was trying to explain, and that I sort of failed to understand.
So because that was a really beautiful idea, I mean, that has then been developed, but I... Yeah, so it was already clear in his mind at that point that the right way to do it was to add a field conjugated to the overlap between two replicas.
Exactly, absolutely. So he had this back in 1978.
And so another thing that I wanted to ask you about what you just said. So your first contact with the Parisi scheme was with the paper in which he already had the full scheme. Because I think there is a first paper where he does one step and in which the entropy
that's
is still...
Right.
You have not seen that one first.
No, okay. So let me elaborate a little bit on that. As I mentioned, you know, we were trying to be a little bit more educated on this symmetry breaking scheme. So instead of doing two, I mean, grouping replicas by two, you said let's group them by p, okay, and indeed, lo and behold, you see that the entropy that you get is divided by p. So you say, okay, so then I have to go to the limit p goes to infinity, and then we are safe. That's not so. Let me tell you. So what Parisi did, as what you say, is the first step, was he said, let as allow P to be a variational parameter. So it will depend on temperature. And so indeed, okay, you see that the trend is going in the right direction, but still, I mean, it suffered from, I would say, the similar kind of problem that we have been faced with. And it is only when he sort of devised this very clever scheme that it was possible to cure everything.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
So you mentioned that Thomas Garel was involved in a lot of this, but he was not invited to the Montparnasse discussion?
No, he was not. No, he was not. Maybe because he didn't have a phone at that time. I can't remember. You have to go back in time a little bit. Nowadays, I mean, that seems crazy. You go to the, you buy a cell phone and then you have your own line. But at the time, getting a phone was a little bit of a challenge. And I could tell you the circumstance why I had one and he didn't, but I think it's beyond the interview.
Sure. So that first paper that you wrote about replica symmetry breaking with Blandin and Garel was submitted in June 79, and you do, and it was published in 1980. But so, and you do mention Parisi. But so how did this interplay of you becoming aware with the solution, your own work, come together?
Right. I mean, the thing is, as I said, essentially the root of this replica symmetry breaking dated back from 1978. It took a very long time before this thing evolved into a paper that was written. However, the idea was already broadcast, I would say, through seminars, discussions that Blandin had with various colleagues, and Giorgio was a, he had come to France on several occasions, and most notably in Saclay. And so he learned about this thing. I honestly may be mistaken, but I think that for him, I mean, I don't think that he had any kind of prior experience in spin glasses. It's just that he heard about these ideas and he had the inspiration, and that was amazing. Unbelievable.
In your thèse d'état, right? You one of the first pages is a caricature by Caron d'Arche, suggesting a certain degree of animosity in the spin glass field. Can you describe that moment and what was the source of animosity?
Okay, so I would say that there were some groups who were competing, the British group, Bray and Moore, they were very clever, very active. They had great ideas, and they were very strong competitors. David Sherrington, from Sherrington Kirkpatrick, was also one such person, and going to seminars and conferences made me realize that people wanted their ideas to be promoted, and that this was a very emotional kind of issue, which inspired me to present this Caron d'Arche cartoon.
So after that paper with Blandin, you worked with Gérard Toulouse, whom you mentioned was also a mentor to you. So can you tell us about how that interaction developed and how this work came about?
Sure, I will. I think that in the order, I mean, there was work with De Dominicis. And if you look at the papers, I mean, the history of these papers, you'll see that essentially these, I mean, the work with Cyrano and the work with Blandin, they follow two parallel paths. Of course, with Cyrano, this was more equation of motions. But I will answer your question about Toulouse. We can come back to work with Cyrano. I think that this was very important. And with Gérard Toulouse, I would say was a very deep thinker. So his way of approaching problems was usually orthogonal to the mainstream approaches. He took shortcuts, but in a very thoughtful way. And so early on, he had, he said, or he thought, can we make predictions, thermodynamic predictions, experimentally verifiable predictions about this model? And at the time, what did exist were experiments on magnetization, on susceptibility. So there was the concept of field cooling and zero field cooling, which even today, are considered essential experiments in order to probe symmetry breaking, non-linear response properties. Usually they are indicative that you have several ground states in competition. And so Gérard said, let me see if I can make thermodynamic predictions for systems which have some possibility of having magnetization in them. The problem of Ising spin glasses had been studied, including when you put on a field, a magnetic field. And in fact, it was not realized at first, but the right way to probe spin glasses, if you do not have the idea that they can be replica symmetry breaking, was to look at the field, the transition in the field. The reason for this is because if you have a spin glass phase, and if in this phase you have a lot of possible ground states in your system, it means that you define a lot of different length scales. And as a result, a lot of characteristic momenta, so a distribution of them, which characterizes this state, the spin glass state of your system. If you apply a uniform magnetic field, it is not coupled to the order parameter, but because it is uniform and it is not an eigenstate of the momenta, you can analyze this magnetic field. So you can sort of Fourier transform it, if you like. And as a result, it will contain all the components of the momenta. So it will probe all of the states in your system, in your spin glass system. And as a result, when you have the phase transition, essentially you see the condensation of the system into these modes, which are characteristic of the spin glass state. So at the time, I mean, this was not really understood, but this was what was behind that. And Gérard Toulouse sort of understood about this thing, but he said, okay, so let me accept this as a fact that we know the physics of the system, the thermodynamics of the system in a magnetic field. By doing some kind of Legendre transformation, I can guess what the free energy of the system will be if I have some magnetization. So if I have some kind of ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic coupling. And so he did this mapping, and he was able to draw a phase diagram for Ising spins, which had three axes, temperature, I would say the variance of the spin glass order parameter, and the ferromagnetic interaction or antiferromagnetic interaction in the system. And you could sort of, I'm sorry, take it back. So temperature, magnetic field, not variance, magnetic field, and the ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic coupling. And then, so you knowing the phase diagram in the temperature magnetic field plane, you could sort of draw everything in the space, in the three-dimensional space of temperature, magnetic field, and ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic coupling between each spins. So he had been able to do that. And then he published this work, and he was giving some equations or whatever. And then I just wanted to reproduce them. And I couldn't. I mean, I did the math, but they didn't seem to agree with the results he was, presenting in his paper. So I was puzzled. So I went to him and I said, look, Gérard, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm probably making some stupid mistake, beginner's mistake, but there is this thing. So he looked at, what I had written and said, I don't see an obvious mistake in your calculation. I told you, Gérard was a very clever guy, and he was very good at making shortcuts. So there was one term that he had skipped in his assumption, and which, I had no credit, no merit in it. I just did it very stupidly, and of course, not using any kind of symmetry, and I found the right result. So he was very grateful to me for pointing out this little mistake. And then our collaboration started. He said, you gave me something, I will give you something back. And this was the the genesis of our work together on vector spin glasses. So essentially, we did three things in this field. I mean, one was indeed to study the phase diagram field, the temperature for vector spin glasses. The second, so this was in Journal de Physique Lettres, if I'm not mistaken, with Vanny Menius. Mm-hmm. Then there was the equivalent of what Gérard had done for the Ising spin glass problem with ferromagnetic interactions. So we did the same thing for vector spin glasses. So that was the second thing. And then there was the third work that I sort of was responsible for doing, and responsibly mistaken, I must say. Yes, indeed, I have to admit. So probing the stability of this vector spin glass problem, because what we had found was that there were two kinds of replica symmetry breaking. One which involved the components of the order parameter perpendicular to an applied magnetic field, and the one parallel to. In reality, there are not two, there's only one. So as soon as some replica symmetry is broken, everything is broken. So the second one was more a crossover. And I had to eat a humble pie because Sherrington noticed it immediately. And he had a student, Dinah Craig. And so obviously they pointed out that I had made a mistake. And I said, yes, you're right.
So is that what led to you writing a PRL, the three of you?
Yes, I know, but okay, so you know now the context. I mean, I've laid it out for you.
I see.
I mean, it's better than retraction, of course. I mean, I was not fabricating data, but I made a mistake.
You mentioned the work with Cyrano as a sort of third leg of that thesis and as being very important in your mind. So can you elaborate how that came about and then why you think that's a really important advance?
Yes. So it came about because, as I said, Thomas Garel was sharing an office with me, but he was supported for his thesis through CEUA. So essentially, he had some, I would say, at least loose contact at Orme des Merisiers, which was where the theory group at CEUA was based, where all the people, Brézin, Zinjustin, Itzigson, Balian, and all these people were. Cyrano de Dominicis was there. And there was there also Henri Orland, who happened to be, he, as I mentioned in the beginning of our interview, he was also at École Normale Supérieure de Saint-Cloud. Right? So I knew him, but we had sort of disconnected. And one time, Thomas said to me, okay, we should maybe it would be interesting to go to Saclay. There are these people, they have some ideas about spin glasses and blah, blah. And so we went, and it was very interesting because I would say that Brézin was the one person who had the better knowledge of condensed matter physics. Zinjustin, Itzigson, Cyrano, the Dominicis, they were incredible in terms of their math skills, absolutely incredible. And immediately, Cyrano, we were talking, this was sort of when we visited Orme des Merisiers. Immediately he said, look, approach, theoretical approach called the Martin-Sigier-Rose formalism, which is about equations of motions. And if I look at Paulus, Anderson, and Palmer equations, I can use it and we can develop and we can find, and it does not involve replica symmetry breaking. We can use innocent replicas, as he called them. Little did we know, of course, because if you look at Parisi's solution, you realize that at the deepest level in Parisi's hierarchy, the order parameter is exactly that you find in these Thales, Anderson, and Palmer equations. But they are all the descendants above which break symmetry. So now we know that this was a quest that would not be so fruitful, but immediately with Cyrano, I mean, you know, he started scribbling on the blackboard, and this is something I've never seen, to be honest. Someone who does not write on paper, but does everything on the blackboard. And Cyrano was the one person who could align all these equations on the blackboard, never writing on paper, never once. Very good, not making mistakes and everything. Except that one time, so this is a little story for you, there was a cleaning person who came to clean the room where he had scribbled, you know, a blackboard full of equations. She erased everything. And the next day, Cyrano discovers this. And I mean, I've never seen anything like this. Cyrano was a very nice person, very quick temper, okay, but extremely nice person, and certainly, you know, very considerate towards the staff and towards cleaning people. But this time he lost it. He totally blew a fuse. But it just took one day to sort of recover everything. And so with him, you know, started the very fruitful collaboration, studying the properties of the Thales, Anderson, and Palmer equations. And so essentially the focus changed a little bit. So on the one hand, you have replica symmetry breaking, and in some sense, Parisi's order parameter is telling you that the structure of the states of your system is complex. Working on equations of motions, Thales, Anderson, and Palmer, gives you exactly the complementary perspective on this, but seen from real space, not replica space. And so there was a lot to scrap there, and we did with Cyrano. So this lasted for maybe 2 to 2.5 years. And again, I would say that with him, I have learned a lot about functional integration, about these treatments of equations of motion. So I'm extremely grateful to what he brought to me, and certainly in terms of the understanding, I did understand that. And in fact, I mean, one of the things that came out of working with him was the fact that then we started asking questions about how can we characterize these states that are the fabric or the hallmark of spin glasses. What do they do? How can we view them? And in fact, I mean, one thing that came out very clearly is that for Thales, Anderson, and Palmer, the free energy is not a maximum. The free energy for the physical solution is a saddle point. It means that essentially not only the first but the second derivative of the free energy is zero. If you think of the second derivative of the free energy, it's like the inverse of a susceptibility. If it is the second derivative with respect to magnetization. And this was indeed one of the strong predictions of the theory, namely that for the correct solution, all the way from the spin glass temperature down to T equals to zero, you would expect some susceptibility to be infinite, the so-called replicant mode, or the inverse being zero. And this came out of this thing. And this in physics is very familiar, in fact, this concept of, I would say, saddle point. If one thinks of a system, let's say even a magnetic system in a magnetic field, for a second order phase transition. So if you write the free energy of the system, you may notice that in the free energy as a function of, let's say, the magnetization shows two particular points in the free energy versus magnetization phase diagram. And these two points are the so-called spinodal points. And for spinodal points, the precisely there, not only the first derivative of the free energy with respect to the magnetization we see, but the second is also. And what this spinodal point corresponds to is sort of a saddle point of the free energy, but it is also telling you that the system may break into domains. So in other words, it contains the idea that you can have a non-homogeneous in space a kind of system. So in some sense, what Thales, Anderson, and Palmer found was this, except a little bit more complicated because this was a disordered system in their case. And the Parisi solution has also this kind of a property, of course.
So you've mentioned a couple of times that you did this work in collaboration not only with sort of senior PIs but with students in your age group. So could you describe how was the dynamics of this and say who did what and how did you get together? Yes.
Sure. So this was really a teamwork. I would say that probably of the three, Henri Orlan was the best mathematically speaking. He had the best experience. So we were all sort of, we divided the task into subtasks, and each one of us was assigned working out the problem, solving problems, and then we cross-checked. So we had ways of testing, probing the others' results. And once something seemed to be satisfactory and we were ready to show, then we would present that to Cyrano in that particular case.
I see. So after your thesis work and sort of the related papers that came about, you left the field of spin glasses largely. What led you to pursue other directions in research at that point?
Okay, so let's say, so what happened was I went on a postdoc to UC Berkeley after my thesis. And then I was introduced to ideas in fermionic, interacting fermionic systems, which in some sense for my short thesis with Zazie, Marie-Thérèse Béal-Monod, I had done a little bit of this, but truly in earnest, I was just writing equations. There was nothing thought about this. But during my postdoc, I was able to be introduced to condo problems, to mixed valence problems. In the group of Leo Falikoff, they were at UC Berkeley, so they were doing a lot of this. And I said, okay, so, you know, I've spent, what happened is, in reality, I spent 3 years on spin glasses and one year on instabilities, as you can see in my thesis, instabilities in liquid crystals, dynamic instabilities had nothing to do with spin glasses. But what happened was, unfortunately, André Blandin, as I said, was really a great mentor, a very nice person, but he had tremendous personal problems. And after 2 years, so after this work was published in 1980, he was not able to continue mentoring. So I had to find some other advisor. So I switched the subject there. And so after 4 years, I defended my thesis. And then I decided to go to UC Berkeley and look for other problems. One, I would say probably, I sort of saw that the field of spin glasses had reached maturity in some sense, and I will define what sense. And people were already beginning to look into neural networks, side roads of spin glasses, trying to apply the same ideas. And I said, I mean, is it something I want to get involved with, the Hopfield model and all these things? And then I decided, well, I'd like to try something different. So that was a good reason. Now, as I said, the field itself evolved in different ways. I mean, one very important direction was dynamics. Already at the time, I remember at École Normale, there was Jorge Corchan, Leticia Cugliandolo. I mean, there were these people, and I saw their papers on the dynamics of spin glasses, but, you know, this was not something I wanted to be involved with. At Saclay, there was Jean-Philippe Bouchot, who was also working on this, and they were in my group. In my lab, I should say, Physique des Solides. There were several groups: Yann Campbell, Philippe Monod, Sadok Senoussi. So they were experimental. Henri Alou. They were working experimentally on these problems. So indeed, the dynamics of this problem. And I said, I'm a great procrastinator, so I like simplicity. I don't like complication. So I said, maybe it's not for me. So I should look for something different. So there was this, this direction, but I didn't completely leave the field, because I told you from studies with Cyrano de Dominicis, we became really interested in this question of states, of domains that constitute the spin glass space. And there was a, I would say, less complicated instance in which you encounter this kind of situation, and that is dipolar systems, which have a tendency to break naturally into domains, and sometimes they break into a regular array of domains, and so this impacts the dynamics and also the thermodynamics. So indeed, I would say surface effects are important, just like in spin glasses, but with less complication. So we did some of that for a couple of years with Thomas Garel. So this was sort of the way out of spin glasses. And of course, for going back to spin glasses, which is the core of this discussion, there was the question of when, okay, so you investigate mean field theory. When you go beyond mean field theory, that's the approach you follow when you consider phase transitions in a system. You want to know if there is an upper critical dimensionality beyond which you have mean field theory that applies, below which you have possibly a slightly different physics, and of course you have the lower critical dimensionality. And the question which came up almost immediately was, does this replica symmetry breaking survive when you go below the upper critical dimensionality? And there were two schools of thoughts. And certainly Cyrano went deep into this this issue, and again, I said, not for me. So, yeah.
So, despite you leaving the field, you've mentioned one particular direction that has been affected by your work on spinning glasses. But has this remained part of your research career, or is this really something that you put behind and moved on completely?
The only, probably the only place in which, I can still think about this problem is if off and on I see a paper devoted to this thing and I say, just for the sake of scientific interest, let me look at it, see if there is anything that that comes out of it. And the other thing, which is funny in a way, is I mentioned that spin glasses eventually evolved, well, not eventually, but at some point branched into these neural network approaches. So I'm seeing now sort of a revival of this thing to some extent. With these training machines. I'm not a specialist, I'm interested, but it seems to me that it's like deja vu. So I said probably I was not wrong trying to find my own path in research, just doing different things.
So during your time at Orsay or elsewhere, did you ever get to teach about spin glasses or replica symmetry breaking or no?
I did not. I mean, I taught for the master's program, so the master's two program, I could have taught about spin glasses, but Bernard Derrida was given. This was an excellent choice. So I didn't get to.
So, is there anything else that you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed or skipped over?
I was just curious. So. I have learned that the superiority of the British over the French is that they will pursue avenues which may seem, uninteresting or maybe marginal in terms of importance. But at some point you realize they have studied this or they have made it available and they have the advantage. So, in that sense, I was wondering, okay, so we know that we can say there is some kind of anniversary for the replica symmetry breaking story, but what attracted you two to sort of to take on this.
We can discuss this after the end of the interview. We're almost near the end of the interview, so we'll discuss this in a couple minutes.
Okay.
Which is one last question. So do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan or do you intend to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I have some papers by André Blandin. Yes. So, yeah, I'd be glad to deposit them. Yeah.
Yes, there's definitely some options to do that in the greater Paris area. So I encourage you to pursue that.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure too.